Station number 8939, Captain Hamerton, Reel 5.
I think you were telling me about the techniques of waterproofing. How did you go about waterproofing a flail tank? What had to be done?
Well, the first thing that had to be done was to clean all the joints. And in order to clean all the joints underneath, it meant removing the armour plate underneath the engine and the hatchways, any hatchways that were underneath. That is easier said than done. You lie on your back, you wield a large spanner and undo hundreds of nuts and try and work it so that the plate drops gently onto your stomach, because it's impossible to catch it any other way, really. And then you've got to clean any oil and stuff that's around the edges. And then I think for that we used the asbestos compound. I may be wrong. The green stuff, the green asbestos compound, and then screwed it all back in again. There was a special compound that had to be put round the electrical parts of the engine, spark plugs, distributor, and so on. The green asbestos compound was also used round the driver's hatches, because they had to be sealed in. And then the other part of it was to erect the air and exhaust ducts, which enabled the tank to go through, I think it was up to 10 feet of water. It's pretty deep, in fact. And also, one had to seal the turret ring, which one did by first of all putting a strip of Cortex explosive in the turret ring and then sealing it with Bostik and balloon fabric.
What about the gun barrels? Another
the
opens.
Gun barrel had a wadge of oiled cloth on the end of a pull-through put in it. And you were the first shot. You first of all had to withdraw the plug, as it were, and then the first shot was supposed to be an armour-piercing shot, just in case there was anything left in the barrel.
To clear it.
Then after that you could get on with the other business. In my own case, when I landed, there was some trouble because we... I don't know whether you want to hear this now, yes? We came to the shore, we saw our visual identification marks on the shore, the church steeple and so on and so forth. But unfortunately there was a large LST with the 300 odd rocket launchers on the deck in the way. And our landing craft slid alongside, bumped alongside, just as he fired a salvo, which was an ear-splitting experience. It knocked us slightly off course in the last 100 yards or so. So I landed a little bit to the east of where I should have done, just a matter of a couple of 100 yards. The first tank went out, the flail tank went out, and the second one, and the LCT lurched forward as it was relieved of their weight, and the current took it against a submerged tetrahedra, and there was a bang. We discovered afterwards that that had damaged one of the hinges of the ramp. I think a Churchill bridge layer went out next. That finally broke the hinge, but he got out safely. When my turn came to come out, I of course very nearly tipped over, and I didn't, but it was a near thing, and the bevel drive box on the rotor must have struck another submerged mine of some sort. It could have been an anti-aircraft shell. They were fixed to some of the posts in the water. Didn't discover that till later, though. We went ashore, the two flails flailed up to the sea wall and backed away as per plan. The bridge tank came forward, but the commander was killed by a shell which landed on the turret, and it cut the cable and the bridge dropped. So we then had to make use of the existing ramp, a stone ramp off the beach, which was sealed with element C and barbed wire. That meant I had to drive up to the end of this ramp, which by now was underwater. The tide was much higher because of the onshore wind and so on and so forth. And I had to fire at the element C.
What is element C?
It is a large steel gate constructed of welded railway lines. It looks like a gate with a rather V-shaped top, and it was pinned to the ground and so on and so forth, and festooned with barbed wire. Now, in order to fire the gun, I had to blow the waterproofing of the Cortex so that I could rotate the turret a little.
While you were still in the
while
water?
Of course, I was clear of the water level at this time. But the business of firing at element C is a lengthy one. We'd practiced this in the Orford area, by the way. And it meant the commander sighting the gun through the barrel at every joint of the welding. And that's a lengthy business.
You mean actually peering down the bore of the gun?
Peered down the bore of the gun. As I say, we called it posting letters. It was also used for firing into pillbox embrasures. And we fired HE and broke up the element C. And it was then a matter of backing out of the way so that the other two flails could go up the ramp and flail. But, oh, sorry, before that could happen, I'm getting this wrong, we shot up the element C. I then had to drag it out of the way because the other Churchill tank, the Avery, which was supposed to do it, only got one track onto the ramp. The ramp was well underwater by this time, the foot of it anyway, and he didn't quite line up, and he tipped over. Sorry, he didn't. He went up, he pushed the element C to one side and drove off to one side and blew up on a mine. But the element C was still blocking the top, so I had to attach a tow rope to it, because we had tow ropes permanently attached to the shackles in the front, and I had to tow it down the ramp back out into the sea. And of course by this time the tide was much higher, and just as I said, right, that'll do, the driver said, I've got water coming in and it's coming up to my neck, what shall I do? So I said, bail out, and he got out before I did, and he came through the turret past me. Anyway, we dismounted our machine gun from the top and a tripod and some boxes of ammo and grenades and what have you, and did a tightrope walk along the jib underwater and dropped off into about 5 feet of water, which was very cold, right up to our necks. But the most difficult thing of all was climbing out of the water onto the ramp, and the pull of the tide and the fact that our clothing was full of water and we were loaded down with grenades and things made it very difficult to get out, and there were various bodies floating around which didn't help either, but we did get out and set up a machine gun on top of the thing. This enabled the other two flails to come back and go up the ramp through where the Churchill had blown up and flail down towards the first lateral.
Along the sea wall?
Not along the sea wall, at right angles to the sea wall. There were minefields on either side. There was a great deal of smoke from the grass that was burning. I don't think anybody had realised how much smoke there would be because obviously where mines had been sown over a period of years, the grass had not been cut, and so there was a lot of grass to burn. And the flails flailed about 25, 30 yards and had to stop and change chains, and then flailed onto the first lateral and then turn along the lateral road and in fact meet up with the other half of my troop, which had made a landing the other side of the strong point.
What happened to your tank then? Was it recovered?
Oh, it was eventually recovered, although I never got it back. But that's when it was discovered that the bevel box had been damaged by an explosion as we'd come out. So we were very wet for about 3 days, I think, but I didn't catch a cold or anything like that. It's amazing.
I think you wanted to say something about the adaptation of radio for flailing.
Mm. It was decided at one of these conferences at Rendlesham, when we were pooling ideas, that the ordinary intercom of the tank between members of the crew was okay, but it would be helpful if the different tanks in the team knew what was going on. Now that would have meant switching over to what was called the B set, which was the ultra shortwave set.
The troop set.
The troop set. But that wasn't terribly reliable. And somebody suggested, why isn't the control box altered so that the driver hears what's going on the main A set? And that's what we did, and we found that was very efficient, because the driver knew exactly what was happening. For instance, in the tank in front, for example, came across an obstacle and had to reverse or do something, the commander would say reverse, and the other troop, the other tanks in the troop, would hear this straight away. It did have some unfortunate effects too. At Le Havre, as I say, we made a lane without touching any mines, and my sergeant was in front of me. I was the second tank, and I wanted him to change his direction slightly, so I said, driver right. I wanted my driver to change my direction slightly, and I said, driver right. And I'd forgotten to change over from the A set to the intercom. So my sergeant's driver went right, and it just happened that at that moment he was crossing a trench, and so he got stuck in the trench, and they had great difficulty getting out, which was a nuisance, to say the least. Fortunately, there was no trouble, no other trouble. But we did make use of that system of the A set coming through to the driver as well.
Presumably, though, that meant you had to exercise great radio discipline to avoid jamming.
Oh, yes.
The troop net.
Yes, we did. We used the B set, the troop net, very little, in fact. The flails were used in what we call penny packets. A troop would be detached. We hardly ever worked as a squadron. I think the first time was at Le Havre, in an actual battle, as far as we were concerned. So we were always immediately under another bigger unit. And the troop leader had to be netted in to the commanding officer's net on the A set. And it helped to have the whole troop on that net as well, so that they could hear what was happening.
Did you find it confusing and bewildering to have to serve so many different masters, being pushed from one job to another with different units?
I don't know that I would say I was bewildered, but it did mean we did an awful lot of travelling from A to B to C to D and back again. And Some knew how to use flails and others hadn't the faintest idea. Some wanted to use them in as gun tanks all the time. And we objected to that because the flail made it very difficult to manoeuvre. We liked them to know that we were on call for mines. Whenever they hit mines, they called us up and we'd do our stuff. But we didn't like being used to go out in front as gun tanks.
So what did you regard your main armament as being for, the gun? Was it for just for defensive purposes?
I suppose you could say yes. When you come to analyse it, yes, I would think so. As I said, you couldn't use the gun while you were flailing, normally, unless you fired off at right angles to your line of travel. You couldn't fire through the chains. So we used to give each other close support, a great deal. We used a lot of smoke. We used a 2-inch bomb thrower for smoke, of course. And we use the Brownings quite a bit.
Were you under one major formation permanently? As you say, you had to serve many different units, but did you have one troop attached to one division and another troop attached to another division?
No, I think it was as occasion demanded. We were quite often we were Canadians, and quite often we were British. And we switched between the two.
Why was it, do you think, that some units knew how to use you and other units didn't?
I think people just didn't know what flails were.
But you did say that some did know, you know, what
you
were for.
Well, they got to know because they worked with us from the word go, perhaps in England, when we did finally do some exercises in the New Forest with working up our assault teams. We got to know the engineers extremely well, and there were various infantry units which had to that were going to be involved in the assault who did some work with us, so they knew roughly what. But of course nobody really knew what flails could do and couldn't do, because they hadn't been used really, except a little bit at Alamein. So it's not surprising. See, different terrain caused problems. I mentioned Le Havre, where the ground was very, very soft. It occurred again in the Reichswald. I got hit as I was crossing an open field. As soon as the tank was hit, the driver realised it and put his foot down flat out, and he was in bottom gear, trying to get through this ploughed field that was so sticky. Well, it was not sticky with mud, but it was so soft he couldn't get out of bottom gear because the weight of the flail was such that it
bogged us down.
Fortunately, the second shot, which was an AP, missed. I heard it go by.
Where did the first one go?
It hit the gun mantlet where the gun emerged from the turret. And fortunately, we didn't fire their main armament. We discovered very shortly afterwards, when I looked through the barrel, there was a great big bulge in it.
You mentioned that you looked down the barrel when you were firing at point targets like the joints on a C element or the embrasure of a pillbox. Wasn't the sight on the gun accurate?
Yes, but not at that close range. Because it was set at nearly 2 feet to the side, I may be exaggerating there, at least a foot to the side of the gun barrel, at 25 yards, 20 yards, 15 yards, you'd be aiming that much to the side. So you had to look through the barrel.
How long did it take you to actually lay the gun on when you were firing on that system?
Oh, quite quickly. I couldn't possibly tell you in minutes or seconds or whatever. Quite quickly. because we had practiced that quite a lot. The loader had to be quick, because as soon as the commander stepped back for having peered up the barrel, he got the load, and we had to fire to get the next round off, because we had to relay for the next joint, as it were.
You mentioned the exercise in the New Forest. What sort of scale were they?
Not very large, as far as I know, because we were, from the time we left Rendlesham, which would have been, I would guess, late April to May, 44, we were now coming into working as assault teams, and therefore our training was with the engineers and the immediate support troops. Of course, at that stage, we didn't know who we were going in with, or whether it was which division or whatever. Didn't know who was taking part either. So who the infantry were, I honestly don't know. But there were, from time to time, some infantry involved.
Did you do any actual landing exercises?
We did. We did one. 3 weeks before D-Day, we'd been ordered to waterproof, and we did, and we moved down to Lymington, where we'd already been a couple of times to practice loading up the teams, the assault teams, in the LCT, because each assault team had a different composition depending on the kind of obstacle it was going to face. So we'd practiced. We only had, it was very limited space to get up the ramp. We had to reverse up, and with a jib on the front, sheeted up, because we were top secret, it was a work of art getting, I think it was about an inch and a half clearance either side.
Presumably it was also rather even more top heavy or front heavy if you got sheeting on there.
Well, I don't think the sheeting made all that difference to the weight, but it certainly made a difference to the vision that the driver had. For instance, when we drove along a road, we had to have another tarpaulin over the entire tank with just a slot for the driver and the commander. The rest was entirely covered. Whereas for the actual loading exercise, we took one big tarpaulin off, and the rotor drum was the only bit that was sheeted up. Anyway, we practiced landing at Lymington, and we had a couple of trips, one up the Solent, and then there was a big exercise, whose name I forget, where we landed on the beach on the east side of Portsmouth.
On Hailing Island?
Yes, in that area. It was a pretty steeply shelving pebble beach, I remember. And the most thing I remember about it is seeing an aircraftman walking along holding a barrage balloon by its string, which struck us as very funny.
How did exercise go? Did it go according to plan?
Well, we all landed. And as far as I know, that's what the exercise was, to get us used to coming off the boat onto a shore. And nobody tells you things, you know. Well, at least they didn't for that. They just said that we're going to do this exercise. I can't remember any of the details now. I remember that we stayed there, I think, overnight, and then had to sheet up. And instead of being carried back on transporters, we had to drive back under these wretched tarpaulins all the way back to Burley in the New Forest. Then we were told to clean off all the waterproofing. Then we were told to waterproof again, so we thought, aha. And then the ammunition came, and then we knew.
Had you not had any ammunition before?
No. And when it came, we had an awful job trying to stow it, because we had far more ammunition than there was room to put it.
Now, you mentioned, you've used the word landing ship, and you've used the word landing craft. What were you actually...
We were on landing craft, smaller ones. They took about five tanks.
Where did you embark for the Channel crossing?
Well, first of all, we embarked from Lymington again and were taken round to a sealed camp. I think it was A3 at Gosport.
This is on LCTs, on landing craft?
This was on landing craft. And then we were in this sealed camp for some days. The only thing I remember about it is that the Canadians in there were shaving their heads and making themselves look like Mohicans, and that the King came to see his troops, and some of us were summoned to go. I was not one, which upset me considerably at the time. I can remember the engineers mending tracks by using plastic explosive to break the rivet pin. And that's about it. I have been told since that two of my crew managed to get home for a short leave by crawling out under the wire. But I didn't know it at the time. There were air raids. Nothing very much happened. And then we were moved out onto the hards and moved into the landing craft. Again, I believe it was the same landing craft that we'd used before, so we knew them. And then we were pushed into the little docks in, I suppose, Southampton Harbour, where we stayed cooped up till the word go.
What was the state of morale like in the closed camp when you were waiting to be embarked?
Tremendous. Everybody was raring to go. We had our final briefings there. Some of us, some officers, were taken out to special briefings somewhere. It was all terribly secret. We didn't get any names. We used false maps. That they were identical maps. I think one in 100,000 maps. But all the names were code names. Every single one. All the French village names had been changed. Fantastic. And then we had models of the exact part of the beach where we were to go. No names. Just that's your bit of beach, and that's the church tower you'll home in on, and there's a strong point there, and there's a seawall which is so high, and you'll need you'll have an AVRI with a fascine bundle to fill in the anti-tank ditch, and a bridge to get up the wall, and if you can't do that, you do this.
Go up the ramp.
Yes, and so on. And that was that, and we were just all raring to go.
Were you able to memorise the area of operations from the model and from the map?
We had to memorise them. We had to have long looks at them and try and fix it in the mind.
What impression did you get of the Canadians, apart from their haircuts?
They were wild. Very wild. But apart from that, we didn't have much actual contact. At least I didn't.
Were you in a different segment of the camp then?
A different segment.